Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Sean Mullen, and on behalf of Evangelical Alliance, the body organising this evening's event, I want to welcome you all here this evening to these wonderful surroundings. I hope you've had a chance to go upstairs and have a look around the exhibits. If not, you won't have a chance this evening, but do come back another time because it's well worth it. This is the third annual C.S. Lewis public lecture. And this lecture series is intended to initiate public debate on the relevance of the Christian gospel to contemporary life, and particularly contemporary Irish life. Why name an event like this after an Oxford academic who taught medieval and Renaissance literature and has been dead for 45 years? Good question. Even if it's my own question. Although Lewis was a brilliant academic, he is now better known for his works of popular theology on social issues and his children's literature. Though these were his hobbies, if you go into any Dublin bookstore today, it's those works that you'll find on the bookshelves, not his academic works. It might seem inappropriate at such an auspicious gathering, in such an auspicious venue, to quote from a children's story, but I get a sense that Lewis would have done exactly that and would have enjoyed doing it. So I'm going to do that. One of my favourite Lewis characters in his books, The Chronicles of Narnia, is Puddleglum, who for the uninitiated is a marshweagle. Now I'm sure you're wiser. Puddleglum, as his name suggests, tends to see the bottle as half empty rather than half full. As he and his companions begin a dangerous climb, he comments, "The bright side of it is that if we break our necks getting down the cliff, then we're safe from being drowned in the river." Later on, in the same story, Puddleglum and his friends are trapped underground in the kingdom of a witch who tries to persuade them that there is no such thing as the overworld from which they have come. There's no such thing as the sun. There's no such thing as the kingdom of Narnia or of Aslan, its ruler. And Puddleglum goes with this persuasion until he suddenly has a change of mind. And he says, and I quote, "One word, ma'am, one word. All you've been saying is quite right, I shouldn't wonder. I'm a chap who always likes to know the worst and then put the best face I can on it. So I won't deny any of what you said. But there's one thing more to be said even so. Suppose we have only dreamed or made up all those things. Trees and grass and sun and moon and stars and Aslan himself. Suppose we have. Then all I can say is that in that case, the made-up things seem a good deal more important than the real ones." This is C.S. Lewis at his best, rehearsing a complex philosophical argument on whether universal belief in God constitutes an argument for the existence of God or not, and doing it in the middle of a children's story. That's C.S. Lewis. And Lewis believed that Christianity was at its best when it was challenging society's presuppositions and ideas and unquestioned assumptions. He had no place or no time for the idea that Christianity was some kind of a private and personal matter that had no place in the realm of public debate. Instead, with great wisdom and often with great wit, he insisted that we had to face the questions that Christianity raised. He said no Christian, and indeed no historian, should accept the epigram which defines religion as what someone does with his solitude. So this is a lecture in the spirit of Lewis, and our theme this year is one he would have relished. Outgrowing religion, does the West still need its Christian roots? So I want to introduce to you now our speaker for this evening, who is Dr. Greg Clark from Sydney in Australia, where he is the director of the Centre for Public Christianity and also director of the Macquarie Christian Studies Institute at Macquarie University. Greg is an academic, but he's also a public theologian, and those of you who would have heard him on Pat Kenny's radio show this morning will know that he relishes and enjoys that role as well. And he's currently working on material for a book which is tentatively titled Australian Christs, Exploring the Ways in Which Christianity is Influencing Today's Australians. So Greg, you're very welcome, and it's with great pleasure that I hand over to you now.
Thank you very much, Sean. And thank you all for coming to hear an Australian in Dublin. This is my first visit to Ireland, and it's taken me too long to get here. And I'm just honoured to have been invited to give anything with the name C.S. Lewis in the title, and also to do it here in the Chester Beattie Library. I've just been upstairs and seen the wonderful collection. It's something I wanted to see for a long time. The old manuscripts, especially the ancient New Testament manuscripts, have interested me for so long. So what a privilege to be here, and thank you for coming to hear me. My topic, of course, is, are we growing out of religion? Are we in an era where thinking people are moving on from the beliefs of the past and leaving them behind as superstitious or unnecessary? And if so, is this a good thing? Are you as affected by that as me? Let's see if we can do better. These are the sorts of questions that have shaped what I'm going to talk about tonight. They've been taxing my mind for quite a long time now, in particular because of a collection of books by a group now known as the New Atheists, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, and others. And the claim of these writers that we'd be better off without religion seems to me that that marks the New Atheism as something new, this claim that we really would be better off leaving religion behind. Now, I speak to you tonight as an Australian, where I have to say religion has not caused some of the deep divisions that it's caused over here. The sorts of divisions we worry about are between drinkers of beer and wine. Nevertheless, religion has some significance in Australian life and has caused me to reflect greatly, especially in the years since September 11. I'm all too aware, however, I've not lived in your context, and that for me, the question of whether we'd be better off without religion is much more one of inquiry than one of history or even personal experience. So with an awareness of that limitation in what I say, let me ask you this. Do mature people grow out of religion? Do mature people grow out of religious faith? In his best-selling book, The God Delusion, Richard Dawkins writes this, and you'll see this on the quotes on your seat there that might help you as I read some of this material. Dawkins says, "There's something infantile in the presumption that somebody else has a responsibility to give your life meaning and point. The truly adult view, by contrast," he says, "is that our life is as meaningful and as full and as wonderful as we choose to make it." Hitchens similarly describes religion as an early phase of human development, one which he jettisoned as an illusion, quote, "before my boyish voice had broken." "I can't believe," he said recently in an American interview, "I can't believe there's a thinking person here who does not realise that our species would begin to grow to something like its full height if it left this childishness behind, if it emancipated itself from this sinister childish nonsense." It's a strong claim. We'd be better off without religion. Well, statistics might be on the atheist side here. A study in the Cambridge Companion to Atheism by a sociologist called Phil Zuckerman goes so far as to suggest that as a society matures, as it becomes wealthier, healthier, and politically more stable, there's a trend towards atheism. There's a long quote on your page there from Zuckerman. He says that high levels of atheism are strongly correlated with high levels of societal health, such as low homicide rates, low poverty rates, low infant mortality rates, low literacy rates, as well as high levels of educational attainment, per capita income, and gender equality. Most nations, he says, are most nations characterized by high degrees of individual and societal security have the highest rates of organic atheism. And conversely, nations characterised by low degrees of individual and societal security have the lowest rates of organic atheism. Now, Zuckerman acknowledges that although these trends are something he supports, it's difficult to determine causality here. Does being an atheist make for a better society? Or does a better society generate more atheists? However, he leans towards the latter interpretation. As people become better off, they stop believing in God. I'll leave any interpretation of that until later on, but Zuckerman's conclusion is that atheism and collective well-being go together. In a more philosophical mode, that recently deceased American philosopher Richard Rorty described a kind of movement through human history from the age of religion to the age of reason to what he calls the age of literature. Now, as an arts graduate myself, this gives me not a little pride to think of literature as a greater stage of human evolution than the other periods, but Rorty's claim is actually a very serious one about the nature of knowledge. He says it was first considered God-given, then carefully discerned by the logic of human reasoning, and finally, in a recognition of the limitations of that thinking, to be considered by a kind of most impressive exercise in aesthetics. Which view attracts you the most? Well, these claims all strike a consistent note. Religion is a thing of childhood. That's the claim. Whether it's an individual's childhood who through moral and philosophical education outlearns it, or whether it's a society's childhood, when the sort of nascent attempts to organise a community around supposedly God-given foundations give way to something that seems more solid and dependable and has no need for reference to God. Well, I have a series of questions to throw back at this claim, and they're simple questions in a way, but they're quite broad questions as well. What debt do we owe to religious thinking, and in particular the Christian faith, which is my topic tonight? What debt do we owe to the Christian faith for the things we hold dear in our society? What would the West lose if we outgrew the Christian religion? Is it even possible to leave Christianity behind in the way that has been suggested by Hitchens and others? You see, there is in fact immense interest among intellectuals at the moment in whether or not the Christian understanding of humanity, the world, and God is somehow basic to social goods. This has to be stressed because the intellectual media often doesn't pay sufficient attention to the voices and direction of this thinking. An anecdote from Richard Dawkins will get a lot more news play than a sort of deeper reflections of a theologian, an archbishop or a philosopher. I understand that. But I want to alert you tonight that some of the brightest, most considered and scholarly thinkers on the topic of Christianity's value to society, I want to alert you to their work in order to demonstrate that they're claiming a very significant place for Christian thinking for today's Western civilization. This is not Richard Dawkins with his vein-popping rhetoric and dismissive anecdotes. This is not Christopher Hitchens with his kind of faux history and often tabloid moralizing, entertaining as it is. These voices come from places of deeper learning concerning how societies are formed, what holds them together, and what is lost when key beliefs are removed. So let me deal with some of them. Charles Taylor, American philosopher, is one such figure. In his enormous recent work that I hope some of you have seen, A Secular Age, he explores why it is that in AD 1500, no one in the West could imagine life without a divine reality, without angels, without afterlives. But in AD 2000, almost everyone can at least imagine it. How did the public mindset shift so radically? Well, Taylor says that the narrative of our lives changed, the story we told ourselves of our lives changed, so that the supernatural was missing. Or to use an image of his, he says, everything about our lives began to make sense within a natural or imminent frame. And God, the supernatural, if they exist, were left outside the frame. Somewhere outside the frame you would find them, if they're there. Now, Taylor writes as a Catholic, but his perspective on contemporary society rings true, I think, for many of his readers. Many people have left God out of the frame, so to say. But Taylor's genius in this is to recognise that this, in fact, says nothing about whether it is wise or true or good to leave God outside of the frame. It just says it's now practicable. He also acknowledges that this new framing of life takes place because of the old framing. That is, that without the old supernatural frame, the natural one would not have emerged. For more on Taylor, you'll need to read his 900-page book as he explores this. Let me give you an example, though. He acknowledges that for humanism to develop, in its, especially its teaching on benevolence, it needed the prior Christian teaching about love. He says in A Secular Age, this is true for exclusive humanism in relation to the Christian faith in the centrality of benevolence. I've even argued that exclusive humanism, this is Taylor, couldn't have arisen without an analogy to agape, the Christian concept of sacrificial love. In other words, Christian teachings have provided the springboard for the humanist teachings about love. But perhaps we've just outgrown the Christian concept. Perhaps we've found something more mature. Perhaps that's what the atheists are suggesting. Is that the answer? Well, we need more information. We ought to look, I think, to a secular writer to get a spin on this. Professor Jürgen Habermas has for 40 years been at the forefront of German political philosophy, seeking a democratic culture from the rubble of totalitarianism. His philosophy sought to articulate a really rational conception of the just and humane society, and he recognised that modernity has as much capacity to destroy human community, as witnessed by the mass violence of the 20th century, as it has to structure and improve it. Having spent decades arguing that religion would have to be right at the edges of this project of modernisation, recently Habermas has changed his position. He now argues that religious thinking is actually at the centre of the task. A long quote from a recent interview will serve to focus his ideas around this subject of religion and social maturity. Again, it's on your page. I want to read you the whole quote, although it's a tough one, because it's very significant to my argument tonight. Habermas says, "Christianity has functioned for the normative self-understanding of modernity as more than a mere precursor or a catalyst. Egalitarian universalism, from which sprang ideas of freedom, social solidarity, autonomous conduct of life and emancipation, of individual morality of conscience, human rights, and democracy, is the direct heir to the Judaic ethic of justice and the Christian ethic of love. This legacy," says Habermas, "substantially unchanged, has been the object of continual critical appropriation and reinterpretation. To this day, there is no alternative to it. And in the light of the current challenges of a post-national constellation, we continue to draw on the substance of this heritage. Everything else is just idle, postmodern talk." So says the secular writer, Jürgen Habermas. Now, this difficult passage is making at least three significant assertions, and they are far stronger than those put forward by the Catholic Charles Taylor. Firstly, Habermas is acknowledging, as others have, that the values held dear in the globalising world, such as ours, human rights, liberty of conscience, social democracy, spring from Judeo-Christian thinking. Taylor claims something similar. Second, Habermas is saying that Western societies have been adopting and adapting Christian principles all the while. That's in fact how we have achieved what we've achieved. That's a much more integrated view than what Taylor offers. And thirdly, Habermas is asserting, to the amazement of his many followers, that there is no obvious alternative vision for human society. To suggest there is an alternative to the justice of the Old Testament and the love of the New Testament is silly postmodern waffle, says Habermas. Even if a society wanted to outgrow Christianity, he says, it would struggle to know where to go next. Here we have an eminent secular philosopher not just acknowledging the Western debt to Judeo-Christian thinking, but saying it's essential to the future. Another writer argues that even when we claim to be a post-Christian society, we do it in a Christian way. In his recent book, A Short History of Secularism, the British academic Graham Smith argues that the West hasn't actually entered a post-Christian age, but a new kind of Christian age in which secularism is the latest expression of the Christian religion. Sounds weird, doesn't it? But He explains it well. He says, secularism is not the end of Christianity, nor a sign of the godless nature of the West. Secularism is just Christian ethics shorn of its doctrine. It's an ongoing commitment to do good, understood in traditional Christian terms, give or take a little bit, that's my addition to his quote, by the way, without a concern for the technicalities of the teachings of the church. For instance, much of Western thinking gives a very high place to the individual, but understands that position has to be modified by the needs and desires of society. Or put differently, individuals who are free to make moral and ethical choices generate a different set of social relations to those who are not. So, for example, persons born into a caste or a class system don't have the scope to forge certain kinds of friendships or marriages or working communities. We in the West often take for granted the high status afforded to the individual, but it only takes a small amount of historical and cross-cultural education to recognise it's far from universal. Rather, this idea that an individual has a moral will and ought to be free to exercise it has emerged from Christian rethinking of the ancient Greek understanding of persons and the Jewish notion of conforming to the will of God. That's where it's come from. It's not a post-Christian idea that individuals have free will. It's born out of Christian bedrock. And the Greek's going to mention there too. Individual rights that we hold dear as Westerners, things like acting on our conscience, assessing what's true for ourselves, making personal moral judgments, are not in fact universal truths, but outworkings of the Christian concept of the will in relation to God. So rather than saying with the Americans that it's a self-evident truth that all men are created equal, some certain inequality in that statement already, we ought to say that this idea of equality actually emerges from the Christian worldview. Christianity introduced the notion that we are all radically equal, writes Smith. People are children of God. This was not the case in classical society. The theologian Timothy Gorringe claims that the gospel story of God's incarnation in Christ, a central doctrine of Christianity, is in fact the key to the Western notion of human equality. So taking it further than Graham Smith to say, actually, you can't just shear off the doctrine and still get there. You need the doctrine too. Gorringe writes, and I'm not sure if this is on your page, according to this, taking flesh, God assumed all human beings, black, white, female and male, Dalit and highborn, cognitively disabled and others, into a full filial relation and therefore into equality, the children of God. In one of his many controversial addresses, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, sought to establish the foundations of the legal rights of the individual. He identifies two significant features of such a foundation. One, that a human being is somehow related to God. And two, that the same human being has a degree of individual freedom. You've got this quote as well. Archbishop Williams says, both of these things are historically rooted in Christian theology, even when they've acquired a life of their own in isolation from that theology. It never does any harm to be reminded that without certain themes consistently and strongly emphasised by the Abrahamic faiths, themes to do with the unconditional possibility for every human subject to live in conscious relation with God and in free and constructive collaboration with others, there is no guarantee that a universalist account of human dignity would ever have seemed plausible or even emerged with clarity. It's a great assumption to think that without Christianity you would have got this valuing of the individual that we hold so dearly today. Now, it would be easy to misunderstand me at this point and misunderstand the claim. It's not that only Christians today hold the view that all people are equal. Rather, this is an assertion about the history of ideas. The notion of personal equality has emerged as a result of Christian teaching. It is, in my view, really wonderful that such a teaching is widely accepted now by people of many faiths or of no faith. But it is also important, I think, to give credit for the idea to its originators. In his recent book, Discovering God, The Origins of the Great Religions and the Evolution of Belief, the American sociologist Rodney Stark outlines the social benefits of the Christian faith. He describes the social moral imperatives of Christianity, that is, loving your neighbour, doing unto others as you would have them do to you, and being more blessed to give than to receive. He describes these as truly revolutionary. Furthermore, he examines the different responses that Christians and pagans made historically to the plagues that struck the Roman Empire back in 165 and 251 AD. Whereas most pagans, that is, the wealthy business people, the priests, the political leaders, I put the priests in there, fled to the safety of the countryside, the Christians, both the wealthy who could have left and the poor who had less choice, stayed to nurse the sick, whether they be Christian or pagan. It's just a historical fact that that happened. Stark identifies the social good that Christianity does as the key reason for the rise of Christianity in the first few centuries after Jesus. He says, it has often been suggested that Christianity just compensated people for their lives of misery by promising them a glorious life to come, often denigrated as pie in the sky. This came up in my interview on the radio this morning. By the way, that was me, not Rodney Stark. But this is Stark again. Possibly so, he says, but it seems far more significant that Christianity actually made life much less miserable in the here and now. The Christians acted on the love command. Again, the idea of loving one's neighbour does not emerge from nowhere and does not receive universal acclamation. Rather, it's a revolutionary idea that seems to emerge from Jesus' interpretation of the Jewish scriptures, of the commands there to express love for those around you. It's certainly not the case, and I want to labour this point, that only Christian or Jewish people express any love for their neighbours, for the people in need. But when we look at where this particular value or ethic comes from in the history of ideas, we're led back to the distinctive teachings of Jesus. Can we go any further with this to say that the love your neighbour command is still making a distinct difference in people's behaviour today? Well, writing in The Guardian in 2005 after Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, the British socialist and atheist Roy Hattersley made an awful observation. Almost all of the aid work was being done by people with Christian beliefs. Notable for their absence, he writes, are teams from rationalist societies, free thinkers clubs, and atheist associations. Now, I want to be very careful here that you hear what I'm not claiming. I'm not claiming that Christians are better people than atheists, although Hattersley himself does make this claim in the article. Rather, I'm suggesting that this kind of observation suggests that the Christian faith often delivers moral imperatives and actual behaviours when other worldviews such as atheism do not. If we want altruistic actions in times of human crisis, as well as every day, we ought to pause before happily tossing the Christian faith overboard. The veteran Time magazine reporter, David Aikman, also makes a distinctive claim for broader social social issues. He's an expert on the rise of Christianity in China, and he's been witnessing firsthand the move from atheistic communist beliefs to whatever is around the corner for the Chinese. And Aikman recognises that capitalism has brought about major change in China, but claims that for the underpinnings of the society as a whole, Chinese leaders are looking towards Christianity. Christian lawyers are leading the way in civil rights discussions in China because, according to the Beijing constitutional lawyer Fanya Feng, quote, more and more Chinese public intellectuals say that only Christianity can provide a solid foundation for the rule of law in China. Well, finally, I turn in my list of supporters to another famous philosopher already mentioned, Richard Rorty. This pragmatist from Stanford famously dismissed religion in most of his writing. However, in his last decade, he, like Habermas, came reluctantly to see a place for religious people in the social project of America. Rorty suggested that there is a kind of religious inquiry which suits our age. He calls it a religion of democracy, or romantic polytheism. Fascinating phrase. In romantic polytheism, the religious instinct of human beings is preserved, rather than attacked or treated as poison. But any reference to capital T truth or God or even gods has to be surrendered. In other words, the doctrine has to be shorn off. He says, theists can get involved in today's social plans as long as they're willing to get along without personal immortality, providential interventions, the efficacy of the sacraments, the virgin birth, the risen Christ, the covenant of Abraham, the authority of the Quran, and a whole lot of other things which many theists are loath to do without. In other words, stop being Christians and you can be involved. Stop being religious people and you can be involved. But Rorty here sees something good in Christianity and in other religions, in the religious instinct, but just cannot accept himself the supernatural teachings. In his last work before he died, he had a dialogue with the Catholic philosopher Gianni Vattimo. And in it, Rorty speaks of his sense of the holy. He says, my sense of the holy, insofar as I have one, is bound up with the hope that someday, any millennium now, my remote descendants will live in a global civilization in which love is pretty much the only law. I have no idea how such a society could come about. It is, one might say, a mystery. This mystery, like that of the incarnation, concerns the coming into existence of a love that is kind, patient, and endures all things. I probably don't even need to say that Rorty's hope is consistent with the hope of a Christian, that love will reign, that a time of peace will come, and humanity will fulfill its potential. Rorty's social vision has not moved very far from Christianity. Rather, one might say it's just appropriated Christianity, borrowed the story, changed the names. Well, what are we to make of these subtle and complex statements about the Christian religion from today's leading intellectuals? It seems to me that there are aspects of religion that thoughtful people of our time feel they must outgrow. But our inquiry tonight, at least so far, is suggesting that there is not really any way of outgrowing them effectively, and that even if we did, we would lose a lot of what we desire. We would lose the connection with the heart. These things are at the very base of who we are as Westerners, what we value, and how we got to be the society and individuals we are today. There's something of an urge to outgrow the Christian moral framework, but it has provided the principles of justice and love and other person-centeredness that we hold dear. There's an urge to outgrow the metaphysics of Christianity, with its belief in a personal God, an incarnate Son of God, a Holy Spirit, a heavenly realm. But these are the very teachings from which the social vision, accepted as good, emerges. Throw out the Christian God of love, of justice and mercy, and of providence, and the teachings float freely in midair, lost in mystery, as Rorty has said. I suggest that far from being immature aspects of human yearning, these Christian teachings are in fact mature concepts, proper and true fulfillments of human needs. Could it not be that these teachings of Christianity, so fruitful for our society, delivering multiple social goods, tried and tested for many centuries, are also, in fact, true? Well, I want to finish then tonight with three calls to maturity. My first is for a mature type of Christian expression. That is, intelligent, informed, and self-reflexive, a quality that Habermas himself identifies as essential in our pluralist post-national world. By this, I do not mean a religion that changes its teachings simply to reflect the etiquette of the age. That would be pointless. But a Christian religion that can revisit its way of speaking, that can say sorry when it needs to, and can try again to express the ancient beliefs about God in a way that makes sense. If I may say so, that's the vision of my work at the Centre for Public Christianity in Sydney, and I appreciate your feedback on how we're doing. Because there are infantile expressions of Christianity. Sometimes they're simply unsophisticated, which doesn't mean they're false, but at other times they are real caricatures, or even lies and misunderstandings at least, of what the true Christian message is. And it's beholden upon all Christians to correct error, to continually explain what is and is not a true understanding of the Christian faith. There's a lot of work to do there. My second call for maturity is for a mature kind of Western secularism that sees the importance of Christianity to our past, our present, indeed our future, rather than only seeing the negative in Christians and in churches. I think we see that kind of secularism in Habermas or even in Rorty. Both are seeking what Christianity claims to provide, even though neither acknowledges Christianity as the specific provision of what they long for. For myself, I am willing to see in Christianity the provision of the longed for by so many of our philosophers, our artists, our activists, our moral and ethical leaders, and so many ordinary citizens. I recognise that it is this specific Christian claim to be true that is so offensive to many people. But simply because it's offensive does not mean it's false. And my third and last call, a bold one I think this one, is for a mature kind of Irish thinker. How dare he? Who gives religion the time of day, who is at least as interested in what's in the Bible as what's on YouTube, who has taken the time to form a view on Christianity and given its significance to Western life. Even if this mature thinker eventually decides Christianity is but a useful delusion, he or she will have at least made this decision through genuine inquiry, not through preconceived and untested hearsay. He may, of course, decide that it's not a delusion at all, that Christian faith not only provides a basis for society, but it also, and even more immediately, addresses the needs of the individual human being in God's world. So that's my modest proposal for the Irish. It's far less controversial than the one Jonathan Swift offered not far down the road, which I think involved eating children. I hope it's one that you'll consider taking up. Far from being childish, one can in fact grow up into the reasonable Christian faith, into its life-giving hope and its neighbourly love, taking seriously the words and deeds of Jesus as not only the legacy of successful civilization, but also a true communication of God to the needy human heart. Thank you.